So without more ado, I shall introduce our speaker, and I'm absolutely delighted to welcome Dr. Akane Kanai here to Warwick. She's actually in Monash. I mean, this is one of the advantages of the pandemic, that we can have people here who are actually at the other side of the world and with a 12-hour time difference. So thank you so much, Akane, for joining us. Akane is a lecturer in the School of Media, Film and Journalism at Monash, and her research areas include gender, race and the politics of affect and identity online and in popular culture. And today she's going to talk about online feminisms and online knowledge cultures. So over to you, Akane.
Fantastic. Thanks so much, Nikki. Okay, so I'm going to share my screen. And I know this was a bit of a lull when you start doing that, but just play from the start. Is that okay, everyone?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So thanks again, Nikki, for the introduction. And thank you so much to Maria also for having invited me to speak. It's really an honor to be able to present this work. Especially as it is a bit of a work in progress, just an FYI. So anyway, I really welcome your thoughts and feedback on it. And I'm excited to have so much time actually set aside for the Q&A as well. Before I begin though, I would like to acknowledge that I am situated on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, and this shapes my position in what I bring here today as a settler and also in my position as a migrant. Before I also launch into it, I wanted to also thank you all for being here to listen to this paper, especially because it is trying to develop some new thinking. It's a bit of a mishmash, I guess. So here I'm trying to reflect on some previous work I've done on online feminism from a couple of previous projects. But as I head into a current Australian Research Council funded project on how young women learn and use feminist principles of online culture. So I'm trying to do some reflecting before I have started the fellowship, but, you know, as I kind of head into it and gain some momentum. Okay, so to start off with, this paper begins from the position that in recent years in Anglo-American media and popular culture, we've seen a real resurgence in interest in progressive identity politics. And this is not only driven by feminism, but I think feminism has a really important and public place in exemplifying some of the movements of this kind of resurgence. We know that feminism is ever present in the media as revelations continually surface of new and old abusers. It's present in brand culture and in the discursive space that's now open in television and film, ranging from shows such as Big Little Lies to Promising Young Woman. Relatedly, in a moment where there's a lot of contestation of everyday institutional racism that has gained quite significant visibility, we can see that US-led Black feminist ideas have shown real transnational purchase, as Akwugo Emejulu and Francesca Sobande have noted, and this is something that has been, you know, taken up by a transnational audience. So this resurgence, particularly in terms of its representative politics, has been cautiously received in the feminist academy, notably in relation to the entwinement of activist politics with neoliberal logics and commercial culture more broadly. So what we can see is that, you know, feminism's kind of quite pervasive but also contradictory cultural presence has made possible but also has demanded the formation of particular kinds of subjectivities that are better able to survive under neoliberalism, as scholars such as Angela McRobbie, Rosalind Gill, Sarah Bonet Weiser and Catherine Roddenberg have noted in their analyses of the cultural environment at the moment. So my attempt to contribute to understanding this moment and to the scholarship in this space is to try to foreground the cultural and mediated everydayness of feminism in its address to women in particular. So to note that feminism, particularly when you talk about digital culture, is not present just in terms of, you know, clear, organized, discrete acts of resistance per se, but also about a more sort of general participation in culture in particular ways. So my own projects have sought to understand the negotiation of, I guess, mediated feminism from the perspective of those identifying as feminist and who have most often been women. I have in particular sought to understand the connections between these, you know, broadly speaking, big picture analyses of you know, feminist culture and lived practices in a world in which digital culture has significantly transformed the everyday practice of identity, as well as remediating access to popular culture and brand culture. So because of this focus on the everyday, while my, you know, research focus in these projects could be described, you know, quite concisely as digital feminisms, my approach hasn't really zeroed in on hashtag feminisms or, you know, online activism with a capital A, as others have done really important work in this area. So the projects that I'm sort of reflecting on today, they're mainly two projects. So one, the first one was, I guess, a kind of mapping project in exploring what kinds of ideas and concepts that feminists were engaging with and learning from digital culture. And the second, based on that first project, was on online feminist deliberation, co-investigated with Dr. Julia Coffey from the University of Newcastle, Australia. So that second project was really based on deliberation, really arose from, I guess, how the first cohort of participants I had were really seeming to struggle with the being able to frankly discuss complex and sensitive feminist issues online. And so the second project kind of sprang from that. But, you know, both these projects were quite small scale qualitative projects involving the participation of about 10 to 15 feminists each, beginning from their own experiences rather than discrete platforms and, you know, movements such as Me Too per se. So that's a, you know, really extremely brief overview, but I'm happy to take questions on that afterwards in Q&A. But reflecting on these projects, what I want to suggest in this paper is that the negotiation of feminism in the everyday can be usefully understood through the framework of contested knowledge cultures. So I frame everyday knowledge cultures as connected to the knowledge economies that characterize post-industrial contexts, as well as the logics of digital culture. And I'll be discussing, you know, quite briefly how this has connected with my participants' articulations and negotiations of feminism. Relatedly, following Sara Ahmed, I am sketching how such knowledge cultures are shaped by affective orientations, anxiety, righteousness, and feelings of obligation. And in doing so, I am wanting to position the knowledge cultures of which I speak as also entangled with academic feminist theory and vice versa. So acknowledging that some of these complexities and conundrums are also what we potentially personally respond to as scholars. Okay, so perhaps I should start off by doing some definitional work. So I'm going to start off in talking about the everyday. And I know there's a lot of political theory out there on the everyday, but for the moment, this is what I'm quite influenced by. And this is Philomena Esed's articulation of the everyday based on her work on everyday racism. So Philomena Issed positions the everyday as a world which one must learn to maneuver and a world that one must learn to handle. This at least includes knowledge of language, norms, customs, and rules, and knowledge to use the means and resources that make living possible or successful in a given environment. So I think what Issed highlights here and what I'm quite drawn to is the role of knowledge, both explicit and implicit, and its mobilization as part of the everyday. And I also draw here on Anne Swidler's contention that to study culture is to study practices that illuminate cultural schemas as well as the material resources underpinning their use. So this view of practice usefully highlights a mutuality of schemas and resources. That is, not only do cultural ideas provide templates for the mobilization and the use of resources, but they themselves are also created based on the resources that we bring to bear on them. So in terms of knowledge cultures then, what I am adopting as I guess is a working definition in thinking through the everyday is cultures of practice around learning, knowing, and making authoritative claims. And that's as far as I've gotten at this point. But I think it's important to also flesh out, you know, how I've come to sort of think through knowledge cultures as a useful framework. So I'm drawing here on the work of Karen Norsetina, who defined knowledge cultures some time ago, but through her work on scientists as knowledge workers and producers in the context of post-industrial economies. So as post-industrial economies and social relations are increasingly governed by knowledge and expertise in the shift to the provision of services and immaterial goods, Satina argues that this signifies a change in respect of knowledge practices. So we see a move from discrete experts situated in different elements of the system towards a general infiltration of knowledge processes and practices into everyday life. And this resonates, I think, also with a lot of, you know, feminist sociological work identifying the sort of move to the reflexivity of gendered individualism in contemporary labor. So for example, Lisa Adkins, you know, talks about how critical reflexivity and the continual mobilization of knowledge has become an expected, even routine attribute of worker citizens, particularly women workers, although that the dividends don't necessarily pay off for that kind of reflexivity. But, you know, there's a sense that knowledge and its use is very much at the heart of new expectations of living under neoliberal life. So Satine identifies that knowledge processes and practices become part and parcel of the everyday. But what I'm also drawn to is the way she talks about knowledge practices as quite affective and underpinned by a relationality that she terms object-oriented sociality. So revolving around knowledge objects. So Satine talks about how, you know, as the ever dynamic nature of a specimen holds fascination for a scientist, knowledge objects have a continuing unfinished nature. They are never closed boxes, but continually unfolding, thus involving a structure of wanting or lack and thus desire. So there's essentially these desiring practices that are at the heart of knowledge practices. And I think this resonates quite nicely with our contemporary mediated environment in which objects of knowledge have greatly proliferated due to the expansion of devices, apps, and platforms where we're continually able to access and search, I guess, for things that pique our interest. So I think this kind of sense of, you know, desiring knowledge practices can predict or connects with the affective magnetism of social media and the rabbit holes of learning invited through endless hyperlinks, the reflex of Googling that has been made mundane through ever-present search engine availability, as Hillis Petit and Jarrett have discussed. And so as our, you know, everyday technology, I mean, everyday for some of us, evidently not, it's not necessarily generalized to all, but as our, you know, indispensable apps, platforms and devices also require continual updating and regular checking in order to maintain our connectedness to the world, we might observe the rise of concurrent desires to remain continually informed, to stay in the know, and to avoid FOMO, the fear of missing out. So the continual everyday desire to remain in the know connects, I think, for me to the orientations of my feminist participants to feminism as a general knowledge object, facilitated by the immersion in feminist news, content, and culture made possible through social media. So learning was a key desire that drove participation in online feminist spaces, whether that simply be lurking to observe conversations or status updates, or reading analysis, news, and so on. So participants created mediated worlds in which they were immersed in feminist sources of knowledge. And this involved customizing their feeds. So this was usually Facebook, but also other platforms such as Tumblr, to produce a steady stream of feminist culture. So for example, one of my young white participants, Lana, a woman who is devoted to a number of social justice causes, explained that for me, it's almost like I'm just immersed in it now. So I don't feel that I'm actively seeking information regularly because it's just there all the time. Unless I see something and I'm like, oh, I hadn't thought about that before, or there's a link or something very specific has happened in the news. It's just more like an immersion than it is active access. Another participant, a young white woman majoring in politics, similarly reported that she followed 30 to 40 different feminist sources on Facebook alone. Another student, Olivia, couldn't count the number of feminist pages and profiles she followed, but said she literally only followed not-for-profits and news outlets. Sasha, a contract teacher, was that person who was always telling her friends to read this or that feminist article and had developed feminist and other social justice-based reading lists for her friends. My PhD student, Natasha Zeng, has actually talked about how this has also become quite a phenomenon in terms of anti-racism. Now there's sort of the proliferation of anti-racist reading lists on social media as kind of, you know, space of pedagogy. So essentially what became quite clear was that digital culture, particularly social media and its entanglement with popular culture as a space for pedagogy, was an immediate and accessible everyday source of knowledge. And this was voiced by one participant who marveled at the literacy of young people in relation to gender, particularly in spaces on Tumblr where she would lurk to learn. I note that participant was only just at, you know, early 30s, and she was referring to people in early 20s, but, you know, youth is relative, I guess. So it was notable that for participants then that feminist priorities were not always immediately about directing feminism outwards, but seeking to incorporate feminist lessons inwards, facilitated by the continual everyday rhythms of consuming feminist content. And, you know, this importance of access to digital culture has also been observed by scholars such as Jesselyn Keller, Alexander Cho, and Bryce Reniger in relation to young people's engagement with feminism and with queer and asexual cultures. So essentially, digital culture was, for my participants, a site of theory. And this was most particularly evident in participants' encounter with intersectionality as a concept that has traveled. And I know traveled is, you know, kind of a problematic concept when talking about theory, but a concept that has traveled across disciplines, borders, and contexts. I think it is important to also critically approach the politics of these desiring practices at the same time. And I have written a little bit on this. So intersectionality was a highly visible and affecting knowledge object for my participants. One of the most frequently cited ideas that participants would mention or that underpinned their articulation of feminism. But the affective politics of becoming more proximate to this object through its citation did not have straightforward effects. So I can only go into sort of brief detail here, but just want to note that the mobilization of intersectionality in its citation was often deeply telling of mainly white anxiety surrounding individual perfection as a feminist and the desire to avoid being tainted with problematic standing. So failing to be an intersectional feminist, or intersectional, as some participants termed it, would result in being a white feminist, and being perceived as such had to be avoided at all costs. As one of my young white participants surmised of white feminists, you know, a lot of American female feminists who aren't women of color just tend to be quite into their own privilege. They just tend to make their experiences about themselves all the time. It's very dramatic, it's very drama filled. Let's create some drama, and it's like, why? So white American female celebrities were particularly singled out for this censure, as opposed to, say, the practices of known acquaintances. And this isn't necessarily surprising, given that feminist online culture might also be significantly intertwined with feminine celebrity culture as an accessible public culture through which judgments and boundaries in relation to femininities can be made. So what I often saw was the work of recitation turning into citation. And so I'm sort of influenced by Claire Hemmings in framing it in this way. But so, you know, there would be the reciting of missteps by, say, HBO showrunner Lena Dunham, who created the show Girls. So her missteps or mistakes could be recited in ways that could then be glossed over, as Dunham's name could then be cited as an instant signifier of white feminism. So this citation, I think, was really about distancing in this kind of format. So it was really about distancing from figures that were deemed to be, you know, kind of irreparably problematic. So there were people like pop star Taylor Swift, Dunham, as I mentioned, the Kardashians. Whereas with the citation of things like intersectionality as a knowledge object, there was a keen desire to become more proximate to intersectionality, as well as you know, figures such as US Black feminist Roxane Gay. So there were kinds of these different knowledge objects that were sort of mobilized, I think, in the telling and the understanding of a feminist self. And I think that what we could see was an affective spatializing logic in these pop culture knowledge practices for many of my participants. I would say particularly the younger ones, in making sense of feminism as a personal identity. And now that I am, you know, kind of reflecting on this, I can't help but be reminded of Bev Skeg's important insights into how class distinction is made through the temporary attachment and distancing from particular cultural objects. So while feminism may be a desired knowledge object as a whole, certain components or certain objects within its constellation in feminism could become favored or abject, problematic by feminists in a social media news cycle in quick succession. So as feminist theorists such as Jennifer Nash, Maria Lugones, and Chandra Mohanty have noted, traveling theory does not necessarily indicate a free and liberatory movement across borders. Given movement is often predicated on geopolitics, it can mean the violent trafficking and use of an idea against its original meaning. And it can also mean the forgetting of the subjects articulated through such theory. And, you know, while these critiques, I think, have been mobilized, you know, in relation to the academy and the academic use of theory, I think in taking this framework of knowledge cultures forward, it could give us a way of engaging with the everyday power relations that are implicit in which ideas are trafficked or moved through space and how. So in talking about how ideas move across space, say, you know, digital culture is, you know, well known to kind of explode spatial boundaries in the way things can move at speed. I think it's really important to also situate this within capitalist logics of how information is organized and circulated and produced. So I have been really interested in the work of Mark Andreevich for some time. But I think so these kinds of desiring practices can be shaped by what Andreevich observes as the broader compulsion to total information awareness. So total information awareness is underpinned by the everydayness of technologies of monitoring, recording, and surveillance, and the production of data from these practices. So Andreevich defines total information awareness as the capitalist version of the fear of missing out. So if everything is known, then all opportunities can be exploited. Nothing is missed. Total information awareness, based on the sensorization of the world, allows moments of slack and lost opportunity to be reduced to the point of elimination. So Andreevich, you know, doesn't really discuss the everyday personal negotiation of this broader idea of, you know, total information awareness as this kind of ideal that has become kind of normalized in our current mediated environment. And, you know, notably his purview isn't everyday feminism. But I think what has really struck me about, I guess, the ideology of total information awareness is its highly affective nature and the kind of desires that underpin the idealization of something that could even be possible at, you know, total information awareness. There's a kind of desire to map the world, to control it, to completely see it. There's a kind of view from nowhere, the desire to transcend location, I think, that is sort of posited as possible in this sort of ideal. And obviously, this kind of view from nowhere has very much been the subject of critique of feminist theory. But I think this kind of, the kind of affective dimensions of this ideal, this sense that, you know, there's the need to exploit all opportunities, there's a need to make sure that, you know, any that all sort of risks are mitigated and that all opportunities are taken advantage of. I think this can provide a kind of context for thinking through the really highly affective stakes for the mastery of knowledge for my participants as key to sort of surviving and thriving in the world and guarding against risks. It was important for my participants to be aware and informed of news, scandals, and political falls from grace for celebrity white feminists and others. And while, you know, I guess awareness of pop culture might be seen as sort of, you know, light and, you know, playful, this kind of engagement was not undertaken as pure leisure. It wasn't something that one could easily opt out of. There was a sense of compulsion, of obligation and routine that accompanied this desire to learn as there was ever more content, ever new developments. But, you know, at the same time, something that Andreevich notes is the flip side of, you know, total information awareness is that what we are faced with is too much information. There's actually no way, obviously, that we can keep track of all these kinds of feeds that are set up through the endless streams of digital culture. There is an info glut as we, you know, struggle to keep up with the reams of data that, you know, stream into our lives through social media customization. So as such, this raises the question of when there is too much information, what processes have to be shortcutted? What has to be flattened, emptied of complexity in order to meet, you know, the demands of immediacy? And what dominates our attention in this overload? So this is has obviously been quite broad brush, but I'm hoping that a framework positioning everyday feminism as a set of knowledge cultures might allow us then to see, understand digital culture as not simply an everyday site or space where knowledge is accessed. Indeed, we know that knowledge is not an inert resource to be discovered free from power relations or contexts. So in understanding feminism's presence in the everyday through the framework of knowledge cultures, we might be able to identify certain orientations and affects in relation to the seeking of knowledge, its deliberation, and its mobilization, and how certain subjects are formed through these practices. Beyond the personal affective relationality that Zatina posits as part of knowledge practices, then, you know, the sort of magnetic promise of going deeper and deeper in relation to a knowledge object, we might see that knowledge cultures have profoundly social and relational effects. So these online sort of everyday feminist cultures were far from neutral or unmotivated spaces of learning, claim-making, and authority. Desires for distinction and desires for feminist knowledge were indeed entangled. So I've now sketched out some of the broadly affective, I think, dimensions of knowledge cultures, but I now want to talk a little bit more about the place of anxiety. So I've briefly mentioned anxiety as an affect implicated in the knowledge practices of everyday feminism, particularly in relation to intersectionality. So this anxiety, I've suggested, has to do with being seen as ignorant when one could be educated, or problematic when paired in a binary with perfect. But I also think this anxiety is to do with questions of authority and how to know in a more profound sense in a fast-moving, information-saturated social media environment, and this entanglement of knowledge with claims to status as social media is a place where you show who you are. In the Global Institutionalized Academy, Tiffany Lothabo King has noted that anxious neoliberal subjects are quick to discard theory that seems outdated, passé, or, you know, too essentialist. And I think these kinds of, you know, affective dynamics have to be even more acute in a social media environment defined by speed, continual obsolescence, and surveillance, where it's not easy to assess legitimate knowledge and how to act politically on that knowledge in the world. In ways of social media activism, there are frequently rapid shifts in perspective on how to use one's platform appropriately, as changing one's profile, photo filter, or post, or use of hashtags and so on might seem like showing solidarity one day and ignorant the next. At the same time, social media users are exhorted to use their clout with their audiences to show their position on issues, as the ideology of social media is to transparently, you know, show an authentic self. And such challenges present themselves even when we are told that it is easier than ever to find answers in the information age. You could just Google it, as one of my feminist participants noted with exasperation on dealing with questions on feminism from lesser-read acquaintances. Or, you know, we could just unfollow people, as another participant observed. Anyone problematic simply has to be unfollowed, unfriended, and as evidenced by the experience of a number of my participants kicked out of the feminist group on Facebook. But I think the sort of continuing anxious self-judgment that seemed to beset so many of my participants suggests that things were actually not quite so simple. There was really an increased self-conscious questioning of how to act as an ethical political subject. And I don't think this is surprising when we live in a moment of escalating desires and demands for, you know, for wokeness. I've been to be sort of socially aware, and I've been discussing this with Francesca Sapande as well. Been trying to write something together on that, but we live in a moment of intensified expectations that the politically woke individual remain alert and continually vigilant in relation to possible injustice. So, of course, there was a clear inadequacy felt by a number of participants. And some participants were really upfront about feeling they always arrived late to the discussion, about being new in particular feminist spaces, not knowing what TERF stood for, or, you know, admitting they didn't originally know the term intersectionality. Others did show significantly more confidence in their political articulation, feeling they knew how to step back and elevate women of colour and trans women in their words. But I think across these varying levels of felt authority and sophistication, it was widely acknowledged that it wasn't necessarily simple to learn and to know and to discuss, you know, obviously quite complex ideas, really, in online spaces. So anxiety in this context, I think, was really connected to the possibility of being wrong in a context of increasing pressure, but also desires to be right, and when one ought to know what to do or how to educate oneself on the correct path to take. So in this context, being right had high stakes. And this came through particularly in my second project on online feminist deliberation. So being right or righteousness could very well be pleasurable. So for example, it could be enjoyable as a group of queer people of color to go correct white girls doing the most cringeworthy stuff, in the words of one of my participants. But not knowing what was right or correct would be anxiety inducing. In Sara Ahmed's words, you wouldn't know how to orient yourself. And too many battles could make you weary and battle-hardened, as my participants would note. So one reflected that it used to be you would feel good for being bright, where you were like, yeah, I made a point. You slam someone down. But maybe it's just being older. I'm recognizing that's not how you change minds. But still, you know, very much this pressure to be able to change minds at the same time. Or another participant reflecting on the feminist Facebook group that she was part of said, it becomes tricky to have conversations because everybody just wants to take the higher moral ground. It turns into putting down the other person's politics as not enlightened enough or whatever. It's quite an ugly interactive mode when I think about it like that. So to be right meant to hold rights, particularly over space, to occupy the high ground. It also gave rights to exclude from one's space or territory. And this had particular significance in relation to private groups. And these were mainly on Facebook. As you know, you would have moderators and admins that kind of had control over who could be ejected and who could stay. So one participant noted of a feminist group she was in of about 600 queer and non-binary people. So she described it as people who had probably felt relatively marginalized or like outsiders generally. So maybe they created this space where they feel like they have the power to now exclude other people. Whether that's consciously or subconsciously, I'm not sure, but it's coming from people who are probably generally excluded themselves or that they didn't have their own space. And maybe now that they do, they're very protective of it. Whether that's constructive or not, it gets very territorial maybe. So because the stakes of being right were so high, we could see it followed that defensiveness was also an affective orientation that characterized online interaction. So it was noted by, one participant in my first project that you definitely couldn't defend yourself if you were seen to be wrong, because this would cause a greater and greater pylon on Facebook. But nonetheless, defensiveness was identified as an everyday affect, particularly in the highly intimate settings of feminist or queer groups, where there was assumed to be more commonality, I think, around what was considered to be right. As explained by another of my participants, who was a young queer person of color, people are used to being defensive everywhere, so it carries through. I think sometimes people are more hurt by someone with a similar experience criticizing them. They feel like, why would you do this if you understand me? They feel it's more hurtful in a way. I guess it's like if someone you like insults you, it feels way worse than some rat off the street because you actually care about their opinion. You feel less validated when someone from your community calls you out on something, because I think people see a call out as an invalidation of all your experience. So what I guess really came through were, I guess, concerns about knowledge being something as socially formed through deliberation, given, you know, the significant challenges that, you know, faced my participants in relation to these kinds of, more complex and personal discussions. While, you know, knowledge was something that was seen to be easily accessed or found, in terms of its kind of making a contestation, there were, there was significant uneasiness, disaffection, frustration, and also in relation to who or what was corrected in these spaces. So this has been a pretty broad-ranging overview, and this is just a snapshot of some of the insights from these projects. But what I think comes through are the really highly affective qualities and practices that shape what is done with knowledge online, and the highly political sense of, you know, how these contestations take place. So if we, I think, go back to the academy, we see the work of scholars such as Jennifer Nash, writing on the affective politics of Black feminist theory, and Claire Hemmings on feminist storytelling, elucidating how we are invested in our theorizing. And this, you know, in the academy, they have noted, can play out in highly defensive territorial moves or glossing over the complexity of feminist thought. Thinkers such as Chantra Mohanty and Tiffany Lothar-Burking have critically questioned how theories about and by women of color can be condensed, trafficked, and consumed in the unequal global networks of academia. And I'm noting this because I found their work incredibly useful in thinking through the kinds of active thinking and questioning and theorizing that was done in the spaces that my participants would discuss. So I think a framework of everyday knowledge cultures can draw on a long-standing recognition in feminist scholarship that our theoretical positions often come from our own experiences, embodiments, and social positions. And indeed, the mobilization of theory in these everyday contexts, I think, can really, I think we can see that they're also subject to the kinds of affective politics and inequalities that these scholars have so perceptively identified in academic contestation. So I guess I'm really interested in trying to create a bit more connection, I guess, between feminist theory and these sort of everyday spaces of theorizing. So I think what we can see is that these kinds of everyday feminist spaces can be considered as a set of dispersed, varying, and often contradictory knowledge cultures where everyday theories of power, identity, and collectivity are generated. They give rise to particular affects and orientations to the world and are key to thinking about feminism's negotiation and effects in the everyday. And relatedly, I think on a sort of final note, why I am invested, I think, in creating more connections between these kinds of insights into the conditions of production of theory in the academy and the everyday is to underline that, you know, theory is something that's not only produced in universities. And I'm not saying this because I think that, you know, everyday feminism has been left out or, you know, anything like that. But I think because this perspective can help to grapple with the kinds of agonizations over righteousness and the truth, which can otherwise be articulated under the not very helpful terms of cancel culture and call out culture, as we've seen. According to Carolyn Ramazanoglu and Janet Holland, speaking on the question of feminist truth claims, however sensitively and reflexively feminists try to produce knowledge and however carefully they qualify and justify their judgments, there are no unproblematic ways of making knowledge claims. And I think I personally find this position comforting. So by casting these kinds of contestations explicitly as part of knowledge cultures and acknowledge their affective underpinning, I'm hoping that it can open up possibilities for reflection and positions to be more than simply wrong or right or problematic or perfect, not just for people like my participants, but I think also as feminist scholars, as we're not only theorists in the academy, but we also, you know, participate and learn from the everyday and from digital culture as well. So I'm going to end it there. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Akane. That was absolutely fascinating. You've raised a lot of really interesting questions. And I'd like to introduce Maria de Mar Pereira, who is the Deputy Director of the Centre for the Study of Women and Gender, who is going to raise some of those interesting questions for us. Maria.
Thank you, Nikki. And of course, thank you, Akane, for such an intense and thought-provoking and engaging set of thoughts. I mean, if these are your starting thoughts, one can only imagine where you'll end up in developing these ideas. So thank you so much for bringing us into your process of working these things out and being able to discuss them with you. Now, I've got three clusters of comments, questions that I wanted to share, and I'll be very brief for them, so we have plenty of time for others to come in. And the three came out of listening to you, and I wonder if others felt the same thing. So much of what you say feels absolutely familiar, you know, obvious. Every day I'm seeing this, it feels very much a part of my everyday experience as a feminist academic, as also someone involved in feminist knowledge cultures, both within and outside the academia. But as someone who has a feet in different social media cultures, so as someone who is not British and who is at the same time in the echo chambers of Portuguese feminism or Brazilian feminism, as I am of Anglo feminism, as I was listening to you, it felt very familiar. The part of me that is embedded in the Anglo-feminist cultures recognizes it fully, but there are aspects of what you're describing that seen from the perspective of other forms of feminist social media cultures and feminist knowledge cultures feel so strange. There's something very Anglo, whatever that means, and we can unpack that in many ways, about what one can describe as forms of extreme individualism, the heightened individual performativity of knowledge, righteousness, that I think are not often, I think in the Anglo context, we see them as intrinsic to social media debate, but they're intrinsic to social media debate in a context of very individualistic, very individualizing activism or activist cultures. And in cultures of activism that are more collectivist or have a different sort of economy of value that is less about individual allyship, individual performativity, social media does function differently. And so as I was thinking, and I was also thinking then, this binary that I've just created is completely then disrupted by the fact that Anglo social media debates, Anglo social media terms, they travel very easily. And so increasingly you get particular terms then and particular dynamics of debate seeping into other forms of social media culture. So I guess my first question to you was, you know, do feminist knowledge cultures have to be like this if we look at them transnational? Are they always like this? And is there a way to stop the exporting of some of these more problematic dynamics? At least I'm assuming that you think they're problematic. That's how I read you. Because that there is something about the framing of these issues as marginal people, because we are queer, because we are feminist, because we are people of color, this is now the right way to do this. And from a transnational perspective, that right way to do that, that is a very Anglo right way to do that, becomes conflated with a sort of a more advanced feminism, a more developed debate in ways that I think are quite problematic. So how do we stop some of this traveling, some of this exporting, or must we, do we? So that's one of my questions, and connected to this is my second question, which has to do, I guess, also coming from this transnational approach to the questions that you've raised. What happens then in the encounter of knowledge cultures that are about being in the know with, as an individual, with knowledge cultures where the dynamics, the focus of the knowledge is different? Now, I'll give you a specific example. I'm an editor for an international feminist journal. And many, many times, I've lost count of the times when colleagues from semi-peripheral or peripheral countries in global academic debates, you know, colleagues from Brazil, colleagues from other countries in Latin America, colleagues from Southern Europe, colleagues from Asia, will submit an article to our journal. An article that is interesting, robust in lots of ways. We'll send it out to peer reviewers. And we have this very interesting situation where peer reviewers of whatever background, but located in Anglo countries, coming from this perspective of, you know, wanting to be in the know, the desire to remain in the know is also about, I think, often a desire to force others to be in the know. Right? Why are you not in the know, as you've argued powerfully? And so these peer reviewers' response to the article from the Global South, to put it simply, is to say, oh, you have not decolonized your knowledge enough because you're citing authors from the Global North. So this weird situation where the author from the Global North is telling the colleague from the Global South that their knowledge is not decolonized enough because it's not citing the relevant people as they are understood to be in the Global North. And so there's something of a paradox of the ways in which the as you say, the immersion in these knowledge cultures in Anglo context creates the sense that, because as you say, I don't have to seek out this knowledge, it's just there. There is the illusion that it's the same set of things that are there for everyone. And so wherever you are in the world, you must be having the same debates or having the same understandings. And so my second question then is about how this desire to transcend location is located, and what it does when people of different locations encounter each other in these spaces of academic debate. And then my third set of questions is, I was very, you know, provoked by the points you made at the end about defensiveness. And it was making me think of some of my own work on knowledge, feminist knowledge cultures in academia, and the ways in which feminist academics articulate a narrative of experiences of power that always displaces authority somewhere else. You know, even if I am a feminist professor, I am marginalized by neoliberal academia, right? Mm-hmm. Even if I am a highly cited a Black feminist, I am these white feminists are. So there's a displacing of authority. And you make a very powerful case at the end of your talk for a recognition of defensiveness as something that maybe is not intrinsic to white women or only to be found among the white feminist, a trope of the white feminist. Maybe defensiveness is something that is not about demographic or even about, you know, identity, but it's about particular kinds, I would say, economies of value in the political economy of feminist knowledge cultures. So as I was listening to you, I was thinking, you know, I'm very interested in thinking, okay, these affective politics, how do they connect to currencies? What has currency? What has value? And how that changes over time. And how at the moment, there's a lot of value and currency to be had in being new, being fresh, being ticking several intersectional boxes. And I'm saying this problematically on purpose to sort of parody some of the dynamics of this. And so I wonder where you see the connection between these affective issues and these knowledge issues and issues of political economy, of value, of capital, however you may want to understand that. And I'll keep it there. Thank you so much, Akane.
Thank you for such thoughtful questions. It would be amazing to have, we have a long Q&A anyway, but I think there are so many interesting questions there. So to start off with your first question in relation to maybe imagining other ways of having, of, you know, producing knowledge cultures. And I think, something I guess that I brought from my own position when I was kind of thinking about, you know, these kinds of cultures is that I think that sometimes, okay, this doesn't always exist, you know, the academy, but I think, you know, the politics citation and, you know, trying to think about how you really grapple with other people's ideas and acknowledging that, you know, our ideas aren't just, you know, birthed by us. They, you know, they obviously circulate and produce through deliberation and through encountering, you know, others' ideas in, you know, in the context of power. And I think there must be other ways. I think that it's very much a product of, I think, you know, where I'm positioned and the kinds of, you know, I guess the Anglo-American context of how knowledge circulates. And even in Australia, you know, I think there is so much deference to the US as production of culture because of, you know, a kind of national sense of cringe about Australian culture itself. And I think, you know, so it's not as though just because, you know, these things, I think, follow, you know, these largely global geopolitical inequalities, but obviously this might not be the same in so many other spaces. But perhaps, you know, others could talk to that, you know, if we have people who could speak to that in the audience. Okay, so second question on how is this desire to transcend location actually, you know, located? I think this, I mean, I don't think any of this is really new in that sense. I mean, I think, you know, there's been critique for some time about how, you know, there's been how, you know, the use of you know, theory, say intersectionality or women of color or whatever, has often been mobilized in the attempt to achieve something that's seemingly universal, but it still comes from, say, this like white Western perspective. So, you know, a kind of replication of, you know, even in talking about injustice, the language we're talking about injustice often comes from, you know, the center of power. So I'm trying to remember the name of this author I was reading in Science, but surname was Lam, L-A-M, and they were talking very much about how even the ability to diagnose injustice, and this was, I think, this was written a couple of decades ago, you know, there was a felt authority. So this was a conversation between a woman from Vietnam and a white American feminist friend. You know, the felt authority to enunciate the rules for even being able to see and identify injustice still came from, you know, this kind of perspective that has been normalized and seen as central and powerful and normal. So, yeah, I mean, I guess this has been going on for some time, but, yeah, maybe takes on a different tinge when, yet again, we're seen to be more global and more connected through digital culture. And the third question, I think, was about how these kinds of affects are linked to economies of value, which is, you know, something that I am, you know, trying to work through. And I've been returning to Bev Skeggs in thinking through this in terms of, you know, how we make these claims to distinction through these kinds of spatializing practices. I think in relation to authority in particular and defensiveness, I think more broadly there is this, I think this greater sort of desire to be right and to have this defensiveness does make sense in the context of extreme individualization, right? Because as soon as you are made more responsible for all your problems and it's your responsibility to educate yourself, to manage yourself, to use whatever resources possible, you know, it becomes just the stakes of being right and doing the right thing become so much higher because that sort of responsibility is taken on and seen as really something deeply profoundly to do with you and your uniqueness as opposed to, you know, your embeddedness in a particular cultural location. So I think, I think definitely that's, broadly speaking, I think, you know, in terms of neoliberal individualism, it makes that kind of anxiety and, you know, corollary of defensiveness, I think definitely, it makes sense that it would flow from that.
Thank you so much, Akane.
Thank you. Now we're opening it up for questions from everybody, anybody. If you'd like to put your question in the chat, that would be lovely. But otherwise, just please put your hand up. I see we have a hand from Tori Khan. Tori.
Hello. I'm just going to lower my hand so I don't forget. Hi, Akane. Thank you so much for that talk. I really, really appreciated it and I was really interested in it. And the question I'm going to ask is less